it's off Willow.
This is Introduction to Talmud and Mishnah.
Where there's some little townhomes, and then
it's April 15th.
A street or maybe two.
And now after Charuta, we're going to begin Mishnah Aleph of Perek Gimel. So, I want to give the following introduction. Again, April 15th. I'm going to give the following introduction. Probably, in the course of learning, you managed to touch upon the textual variants that we have in this Mishnah. If you didn't get to it in Charuta, we'll certainly get to it now in the Shiur. So I wanted to give an introduction to this matter of textual variants. First of all, let's just know the word. The word for textual variant in Hebrew is girsa. Girsa. Gimel Resh. Samech Aleph.
Are we done with the Charuta now?
Yes, we are.
Textual variants.
Textual variants. And in the plural, girsaot. We will be seeing, if you didn't see already again in the Charuta, a number of different textual variants, a number of different girsaot of this Mishnah, and the question probably arises in your minds, where did this come from and what's happening? So let's remember that from the year 200, when the Mishnah was first edited, until someplace in the 17th century, many Jews were learning Mishnah from handwritten texts, from manuscripts, right? From kitvei yad, that's the word for manuscript. Kitvei yad means the writing of a hand. And even after the printing press was invented, still at least for another 100 years, most Jews were learning from the manuscripts that were around. And even after the printing press, there were manuscripts still circulating and being copied. So whenever you have such a system in which people learn from manuscripts and manuscripts are copied from manuscripts, and then manuscripts are copied from manuscripts that are copied from manuscripts that are copied from manuscripts. And this is going on, like I said, from the year 200 until at least the 17th century. It's inevitable that errors are going to creep into the text.
But isn't it surprising, considering that how careful we are with a Torah scroll text?
It's surprising. It could go in both directions. Surprising how accurate. Let's talk about the Torah text. As far as the Torah, obviously tremendous efforts are made to make sure there's absolutely positively no mistake that creeps into the Torah text, and still there are. Through so many decades and through so many centuries, we've managed to keep the text basically stable, but there are errors, and to this very day, errors are found, and we do know that there's approximately, I think, 17 places in the Torah in which we're not exactly sure if it's an Aleph or a Vav or a Yud. There are little discrepancies. That's a whole other subject. But it's true that even in the text of the Torah, there are errors that have crept in. But let's put that aside. In the Mishnah, there are tens of manuscripts available today that are from the 10th century, or from the 12th century, or from the 14th century, or from the 15th century. They're in different libraries. Some are in the Jewish Theological Seminary Library in New York. Some are in the library in St. Petersburg in Leningrad. Some are in the Vatican Library. Some are in Oxford, or the Bodleian Library, wherever that is. It's also in England, I think. And some are in the Hebrew University on Mount on Givat Ram in Yerushalayim. We have different texts because mistakes have crept in. Now, we often find that different geographical locales have their own tradition of text. Since for many hundreds of years we didn't have mass communication, and the French Jews copied from French texts throughout the generations, and the Jews in Provence from provincial texts, and the Jews in Spain, etc., and the Jews in North Africa, sometimes errors crept in, and those errors were
propagated.
That's a better word, but propagated, such that we have the textual tradition of Provence as opposed to the textual tradition of North Africa. Those things happen. And furthermore, sometimes we have the following. The Mishnah was learned through the course of the generations, both as an independent text, as we're learning here, as Mishnah after Mishnah after Mishnah, is also learned as part of the Talmud, which you have it embedded in the Talmudic text. So you have scribes who are copying the Mishnah as an independent text, and then scribes copying from that copy, going on again for hundreds of years. And parallel to that, you have the text of the Mishnah that's found in the Talmud, which is copied and recopied and recopied as part of the Talmud. And sometimes you'll have the following phenomenon. An error will creep in to the Mishnah as it's found in the Talmud, but not into the Mishnah that's found in a separate text. And after 300 years, you see a tradition of what the Mishnah looks like in the Talmud, and looks different in the Talmud than it looks like in a separate text. And we're going to encounter that right here. So how did these things happen? How did textual variants enter into our received text? Either a mistake, and such things do happen, and sometimes we can understand how mistakes get in there. Mistake. Number two, we have censorship. Either the Christian authorities change a word or force the Jews to change a word, or we have self-censorship in which the Jewish scribes take out a word or change a word for fear of what the Christian censor will say. So there's two different categories of censorship. So we have mistakes, we have Christian censorship, we have self-censorship, and number four, we have corrections. Corrections means a place where the scribe doesn't understand and he thinks it must have a mistake. So he changes it to make it clearer. I actually learned in university when I was taking a high-level class in Midrash, the rule is if you have different textual variants, the one that makes the least sense is usually the more original one. The ones that make more sense have probably been corrected by scribes who are trying to understand. So you have four different types of reasons why texts have variants. Either, again, a mistake, or Christian censorship, or self-censorship, or corrections.
Improvements.
Right. And the last thing that has to be said is there might be cases in which textual variants go back to the source. In other words, there might have been, at the very beginning, two different versions of the Mishnah. The Rabbi Yehuda Nasi had, let's say, a first version and a second version. Mm-hmm. And one version was codified in this manuscript tradition, and this one was codified in this manuscript tradition. So it might not be a mistake at all, and it might not be a correction at all, and it might not be a censorship whether Christian or Jewish. It might be that's the original form, that there was never to begin with one standard text. That's probably rare, but in theory it could be. So that's an introduction to the whole world of textual variants. Here we go.
Last point, isn't it correct that there were brises, for example, that were almost exactly the same as a Mishnah, which shows there were two forms sometimes of virtually the same statement, but one was chosen and
right,
another one wasn't
chosen. That's certainly true.
So in the same way, two could have been taken in different manuscripts.
Well, as far as the Mishnah goes, there was one man who made a final version. It's not like the Braitot that were ideas that were learned in different Batei Midrash and never codified. The Mishnah was codified, but even though it was codified, it still could be true that there were some places in which there wasn't a final version. Or there are two final versions. Okay, so here we go with the Mishnah. Perek Gimel, Mishnah Aleph. Mi shemeito mutal lefanav patur mikriyat shma minat fila minat filin. So we understand that Mishameto Mutalef Hanav means someone, me, who, that his dead is placed before him. And we have to define what it means, his dead. His dead in what sense? And that brings us to the verses in Sefer Vayikra that you saw, which you see the Kohen is allowed and therefore commanded to defile himself to see to the needs of seven dead, right? Father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter, and spouse, wife. You saw in Rashi, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I brought up this argument with my colleagues and associates, where is spouse?
So I heard you talking a little bit.
And the reason specifically is ulachi, ulachotav, and all that. But imav is without the conjunctive and.
No, wait a second. Your spouse, imo is his mother. You're talking ishto.
No,
you said.
It does not say ishto.
Doesn't it say shiro hakarov alav?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that is interpreted to mean wife. I understand it doesn't say that.
Right, I understood, but it's the conjunctive that's missing.
Right,
there.
So, but that's another subject. I understand, but I'm sorry. Not going to take time to go into that, and I don't have much to say. So, mito mutal lefanav, it's mito in the sense of halachic obligation. Right? Even if you're in a room with a dead body, it's not necessarily mito unless halachically you have an obligation to see to their burial. Of course, there is one additional case of mito, and that's what's called meit mitzvah. If you find a dead body and there's no one else to deal with it, then by the virtue of the fact that you found it, it becomes your mate, your responsibility. But that's a rare case. Usually meito means someone whose halachic dead is in front of him. Now, we have to understand, it doesn't just mean in front of you in the physical sense. It could mean in front of you in the halachic sense. In other words, if it's your dead body, your chas v'shalom mother, father, sister, brother, son, daughter, or spouse, even theoretically, if you're in Texas and the body is in Tel Aviv, your meito is mutal lefanecha. It's mutal lefanecha, not in a geographical sense, but in a halachic sense, that it's upon you, it's in front of you to deal with. So I can't be sure that that's what the Mishnah meant, but halachically that's the halacha, that you can be in the category of having your mate that makes you patur, even if it's in a different city in a different country. Okay. So someone who is in this situation, I heard you discussing in some kavrutot, is called an onen. From the time of word of death reaches you until the burial, you're an onen. And the period is called aninut. You become an avel, and you enter into avilut from the time of burial. Now we have to be careful here. The word avel and avilut has a double meaning. It's the name of the category and the name of the subcategory. So don't get confused. We could say on one level that from the minute of death, if it's a death of your mate, halachically, you become an avel. But the type of avel you are is an onen. But then after burial, you become an avel in the second sense of the word. Like if I would draw, you know, a chart, I would say, here is avel, and has 10 different categories. One of the categories is called avel. And one of the categories is called onen. By the way, we have the same thing, and this happens again and again in halacha. I have to make sure you don't become confused. The word chita, meaning wheat, refers to one of the five grains, but it's also a generic name for all of the five grains. The same thing with the word ben. The word ben means child, and also means a male child. Again, the word av can mean parent, or could mean a male parent. You always have to be careful. You're talking about the category or the subcategory. So the word avel and avelut can be both the category or the subcategory, and another subcategory of avel is onen. The period is called aninut. So we're talking here about onen. Misha meito mutal lefanav, patur mikriyat shma minatfila minatfilin. Did anyone get to the text, I don't think you did, of the Talmud Yerushalmi on this first part of the Mishnah? So let's look at the Talmud Yerushalmi. You'll see something interesting there. But I gave it out.
Yeah.
Talmud Yerushalmi, I put it on the table when you were studying, if you don't have one. So the text of the Talmud Yerushalmi is the text of the Mishnah that's found in the Talmud Yerushalmi. This is the Bavli.
Talmud Yerushalmi.
Oh. This is the Bavli. He has a Bavli. I have a Bavli in my hand. Here's another Bavli. That's the Yerushalmi.
Yeah.
Okay. That's, it says in my handwriting, Yerushalmi at the top. And in the middle of the page begins Perek Gimel. Right? Where my bracket is Perek Gimel. If you want to look, everyone sees. Okay, so it says, Misha meito mutal lefanav, patur mikriyat shma uminat filin. Something's missing. What's missing?
Tefillah
is missing. It doesn't say that he's patur from tefillah. Whereas our Mishnah says he's patur mikriyat shma, Umina tefila, umina tefilin. So that might indicate a different halachic understanding, or it might be not a halachic understanding. It doesn't include the word. That doesn't mean it holds that the halacha is different. But there might be a reason, which we'll get to another half an hour if we get to it, why the word tefillah is missing. It might be an effort to make sense of the Mishnah. Okay, so we'll go back to that later. Let's see if there's any questions we want to talk about here. Let's talk about connections to the previous chapter. Just to remember that this is part of a larger literary unit. So we remember that the previous chapter indeed referred to a situation identical to or similar to Mishum Meito Mutal Lefanav. What was that? Where did we see that Meito Mutal Lefanav or something similar in the previous chapter?
Rabban Gamliel's wife.
Right, Rabban Gamliel's wife passed away. And it says, Belaila Harishon, he washed. Now we don't know from there if she was buried or not already. She probably was buried because they tried to bury very quickly. So it might not be Meito Mutal Lefanav in the sense of Aninut, but certainly in the sense of Avilut, the subject of Avilut. And not doing certain mitzvot during Avilut came up in the previous chapter and it comes up again in this chapter. That's point number one. Right? What else ties this chapter into the previous chapter? Not just this matter of death.
One mitzvah at a time?
Say it again?
Doing one mitzvah at a time?
What is the principle? How do you say it?
Osek the mitzvah patur min
mitzvah. Right, osek the mitzvah patur min mitzvah.
Osek a mitzvah?
Osek the mitzvah patur min mitzvah. Right, Rabban Gamliel was osek in the mitzvah of getting married, and we talk about what exactly the halachic definition might have been there, and therefore he was exempt from Kriyat Shema. And the same thing in our chapter. Someone is osek the mitzvah of kivura, the halachic obligation of burying the dead, seeing the needs of the burial of the dead, and the same thing is patur mikriyat shema. So these themes are continuing on. Sekhba mitzvah, patur min mitzvah, and specifically concerning the dead, you have it here. And then, the similarity goes further, because it's not just the fact that osek b'mitzvah patur min mitzvah, that you're doing a mitzvah, therefore you're exempt from any other mitzvah. We learned in the previous chapter concerning Rabban Gamliel on the wedding night, even if he wasn't right now doing the mitzvah of the ma'aseh, rather he's preoccupied, he's leading up to it, he's thinking about it, he is tarud, he's preoccupied, we said. Rashi's phrase was tirdad de mitzvah, preoccupation of mitzvah. And that's an extension of the rule of osek b'mitzvah. It's not just that you're exempt when you're doing one mitzvah, you're exempt from another. Even if you're about to do another mitzvah, you're preparing for it, you're thinking about it, you're already exempt from the other mitzvah. The same thing here in our Mishnah. It's not that you're on the phone with the cemetery, therefore you can't say Kriyat Shema. But rather you're thinking about when you're going to call the cemetery and what you're going to do, just the tirdav, having meito mutal lefanav, the tirdav itself is enough to exempt you from Kriyat Shema. So really we see that this chapter continues the theme of the previous chapter, not just that we're talking about mate and being exempt from Shema, but even that death, and secondly not just talking about exempt from Shema because of Osek B'mitzvah, but even more than that, it's not just Osek B'mitzvah, it's even the Tirda, the mitzvah that connects us to the previous chapter. Okay. I asked a question, number five, which is kind of, funny, interesting. Do you think that Rabban Gamliel said the Shema when his wife passed away and her body was mutal lefanav?
Yes.
And you're probably right. How do you prove it?
Because he said that he wouldn't be away from acknowledging the yoke of heaven for a moment when it's...
Okay. Can you prove the opposite?
Yes.
Yeah. How?
We had that argument. when he washed, and acknowledged that the reason for washing was because of his human frailty.
Right, can you explain yourself?
The logic being, I'm looking to ease my here and now because of my physical condition.
Yeah.
Therefore, again, if I look at Rabbi Gamliel and I'm saying I'm trying to ease my here and now, I would exempt myself from the Shema.
You'd exempt yourself.
Those are two
different things. But he said the Shema. You're wanting to know why he said the Shema.
I'm not sure now. Did he say it or did he not say it? I'm opening the question. Did Rabbi Gamliel say the Shema on the night that his wife died?
What are you saying? No.
You're saying no.
Right. I'm saying for him.
And Amiram said yes. I think we can prove the answer is no, differently than you. Because we learned from our Mishnah right now, today, that someone whose dead is placed before him is exempt from Shema. He's exempt. But the question is, did he do it anyway? So in the previous chapter, it gave us a list of things that he did anyway. Things that he did when he was exempt, or he was not supposed to do this, when he went against the grain. And I would say that had he gone against the grain and said Shema when he's exempt, when his wife's body was in front of him, it would have said that. It didn't say that. In Perek Bet, it gave all the examples in which he went against the grain.
I see.
And the most it could do, the most radical step he could take vis-a-vis death, was washing. Mm. If he had said Shema, that would have been up in lights.
Okay.
I think. And that brings us to Masechet Smachot. Masechet Smachot is what's called one of the minor tractates of the Talmud. One of the minor tractates, I'll give these out. Here's, I don't think I have enough, so let's just pass them around. And we know, remember I've told you many times, the stories of Breitot. That the Breitot were thousands upon thousands upon thousands of little teachings that were floating around in different Bate Midrash until the year 200 of the Common Era. In the year 200 of the Common Era, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi took some of the Breitot, those that most authoritative and most concise, and compiled them into the Mishnah. And at that point, everything that was not in the Mishnah got the name of Breitot, which means external. And later in Jewish history, some of these Breitot were collected in collections. The Tosefta is the most famous collection. It's the biggest. It parallels the Mishnah. Other places they were collected was in the Talmud, in the proper Masechet. And there's also, I don't know, between 30 and 100 other tiny collections of Breitot. And some of them are Breitot collected by geographic locale, and some by formalism, in other words, Breitot that have the number 3 in them, or the number 5 in them. And some are collected by subject. And the Breitot that are collected by subject are found in what's called the minor tractates. There's a tractate called Tefillin, which is not a tractate of Talmud. It's a collection of Breitot, the subject of Tefillin. And there's a tractate called Smachot. Again, it's not Talmud. It's collections of Breitot. And in tractate Smachot, this is Lashon Sagi Nahor. We probably won't talk about that. It's a euphemism. It means the opposite of what it says. The tractate of Smachot is about death. And in Perek Asiri, the beginning of the 10th chapter of Masechet Smachot, it says, Avel, a mourner, calls man shemito mutal lefanav, all the time that his dead is in front of him, and again, it doesn't necessarily mean in front of him geographically, it could be halachically, patur mikriyat shema, minatfilah, umikol hamitzvot amarot b'torah. He's exempt from shema and from tefillah and from all the mitzvot that are mentioned in the Torah. Vim ratza lachmir al atzmo. And if he wanted to be stringent upon himself, hareze lo yachmir. Behold, he will not be stringent. You're not allowed to say shema or to do any of the mitzvot when you are an onein. You can't. Not just that you're exempt, but you're not allowed. Why? Mipnei chavod hamet. Because of the honor of the dead. You're not allowed. You can't. Okay, so Rabban Gamliel probably didn't. And not just because it says it here, but because we tried to prove textually, had he done it, it would have had it up in lights, I would think. And then this reminds us that whenever one wants to be machmir on something, you have to be careful that you're not being mekel on something else. Right? You would think, well, I'm going to say Shema, I'm going to be machmir on myself, I'm going to be really religious. No, but you might be being machmir on Shema, but you're being mekel on another mitzvah of kavod amet. You always have to weigh. If you're gaining something, you have to see you might be losing something.
So how can I justify this? How can I justify that I am violating kavod amet?
You can't.
But
you're not
allowed. I should. Well, my point. I don't know. By saying maybe this is why it's relegated to the smechot. I struggle to understand why saying Shema in this case is something that would be categorized as
because of Kavod. And therefore Rabbi Kaplan wouldn't have.
Gotcha. Oh well. Further. A violation of Kavod Amet.
I see. I can say something trivial that you essentially have to be totally dedicated for those 12 hours or 8 hours until the burial, totally and absolutely focused on your obligation towards the mate, and anything else should not be on your mind. Nothing else. Not on your mind and not on your plate.
Is it also a reasonable position that part of the reason this pasuk is in this masechet is simply for that reason?
For what reason?
That the same trouble I have justifying it, the same logic I'm looking for justifying it.
It's possible, yeah, right. Anything that's in a braita and is not included in the Mishnah, you can always say it's not included because Rabbi Yehudansi had some problem with it. That in theory, yes.
I have a question. To me, I'm trying to understand that the piyuv here is to address the goof, the sacredness of the goof, to bury it, give it proper attention, so forth, and neglect the concept of addressing the neshama at the same time, or relegating the neshama to a secondary status.
The question is, whose neshama? Yours or the dead?
The dead.
What can you do for the neshama of the dead?
Do you neglect it because you're preoccupied totally with the goof?
What do you mean neglect it? What can I do for the neshama of the dead? I can only serve the needs of the body. What can I do for the neshama of the dead?
It's the priority of the time. It's the only thing that can be done. And has to be done.
And what else would you like me to do?
You can't be thinking of the spiritual aspect of the person.
He's saying you can think about it, but there's nothing you can do. Physical.
I mean, there's no prayers involved for pertaining to the nefesh.
We have a custom of saying Tehillim while we're doing Shmirah of the goof. And of course, there are prayers that are said at the moment of death. But I don't know of anything. I don't know. Perhaps there are things I don't know about. Okay. I think that we're going to go on.
Okay, so just one quick thought. Mm-hmm. You brought it up when you came over to us, making a comparison, at least for this aspect, which is the end of life. So perhaps because it's the end for this person, right? So the focus should be completely on them because that's it. There should be nothing to take away from that. In the other cases, on the wedding night, saying Shema, perhaps washing. Mm-hmm. Well, that was when his wife was in front of him when she was dead. But all I'm thinking is that the focus is on this is the very last thing that can be done for this person, and perhaps nothing should take away from that in any way.
Well, yeah, isn't there a time?
Kavod Hamet.
Kavod Hamet.
Simply.
There's a time, I mean, there's a priority and urgency to bury the body as quickly as possible.
Right.
So there's a time constraint in that.
Right, that's important to mention, right? Part of Kavod HaMet is to make sure that the body is buried as quickly as possible. The truth is that in America you see it less, but I've been to more than one funeral at 1 a.m.
Yeah. Also, it would take longer back then, it seems like, for just an ordinary person that doesn't have the experience to do that himself. To, I mean, it just seems like you can outsource it now.
Yeah.
But it just seems like it would, you know, since you can't outsource it, you can't, you're not going to have time to do anything else but do that yourself.
Right. You immediately deal with the needs of the dead. I mean, you know, I've seen many cases in which someone died Motzei Shabbat, and 1 a.m. I got a phone call, come to a funeral. I remember one case, you know, picking around on Haaretz Eitim, the Mount of Olives, trying to, with carrying the body, trying to find the grave, because there was no light. And it was late at night, and we barely had a minyan. Another example, the same type of thing, is when my wife's mother passed away, she didn't make it to the funeral. By the time she got there, it was, 15 hours after the funeral. Immediately upon death, especially in Yerushalayim, the custom is to bring the body to burial as soon as possible.
You won't even wait for the child to show up?
There are different customs, but at least in Jerusalem, they don't wait for anyone. Don't wait for anyone. Yeah.
Here there are customs that call for that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well,
the consideration is given.
Yeah. The categories show up, that's it. The fact that aunts and uncles didn't make it, too bad, so
right.
Sad.
Okay, so we're getting to questions 9 and henceforth. In question 9, it says, in light of the material contained in the previous chapter, how can we understand the mention of tefillah in the first section of the Mishnah? And that's where the Mishnah says that patur mikriyat shema o mina tefillah. So what I meant to point out here is that the previous chapter,
question
9, was involved in making a distinction between tefillah and kriyat shema, based on their different characters. Whereas here, we see that the needs and the kavod of the met is so powerful that it's not just kriyat shema, it's tefillah, everything is set aside. Right, we talked about the fact that, for example, you're allowed to blemish kriyat shema to say hello to your fellow. With tefillah, that's not the case. Tefillah has to be said properly. You don't talk to people while you're saying tefillah. But here, for the mate, everything falls by the wayside, even tefillah, not just kriyat shema. And we saw in the girsah, in smachot, that all the mitzvot are set aside for the mate. Let me remind you of this. Our Mishnah, I'm going to put things together now as far as the girsah of what is included in the patur for the mate. Our Mishnah says Shema and Tefillah and Tefillin. In the Talmud Yerushalmi, it didn't say Tefillah. In the Talmud Bavli, it says, like in Masechet Smachot, it says Kriyat Shema and Tefillah and Tefillin and Mikol HaMitzvot Amarot B'Torah, and all the mitzvot mentioned in the Torah. We have many different girsot here. Many different girsot. But in the end, it's all the mitzvot of the Torah.
But is part of that based on the way that the material is organized? That it's focusing on...
You're right. And that's, I hinted at that earlier. I said the fact that our Mishnah doesn't say all the mitzvot might not mean... I don't want to use too many negatives. It still could mean that you're exempt from all that, but that's not the focus of the Mishnah. The Mishnah wants to talk about Shema and Tefillah. Yes. Okay. So now, let's continue on the same subject, which is question 10. The same... Yeah.
Could you comment on... I think this is Rashi that's in the bottom where he tries to explain Minat Tefillah.
Uh-huh.
Third line from the bottom.
You want me to read it there?
Is it?
That's related to the end of the Mishnah.
Oh.
I'm not even sure if we'll get that far today. I hope we will.
Okay.
I'm going to leave that aside for a moment. I want to do something quickly.
I forgot, where was I? Right.
Oh, I think okay. It's from the second, one okay. In the second line.
Okay, so I want to do this now. Right, okay. Let's look now at the second part of the Mishnah. And I'm going to put some things together. The second part of the Mishnah begins with Nosei Hamita. And I'm going to read it with the proper conjunctions and prepositions. So it's like this. Concerning the Nosei Hamita, right? Concerning the bearers of the bier, v'chilufeihen, v'chilufeihen, whether, I'm going to translate et as whether, whether those before the mita, or whether those after the mita, and remember the two lines, remember those before the mita haven't yet carried it, those behind the mita have carried it. Those that the mita needs them are exempt. And those that the mita doesn't need them are obligated. Now the question first is, obligated and exempt from what? From what? Well, if you read the third part of the Mishnah, Elu velu piturin min tefillah, these and those are exempt from tefillah. So the second part wasn't talking about tefillah. It was talking about something else. It was talking about Shema.
Too.
Good point. But now look at the first part of the Mishnah. The first part of the Mishnah said, "Mishem meito mutalef anapatomi kriyat shema minat tefillah." If it mentioned there Shema and tefillah, then I think the second part that just says patur and chayav is talking about the same thing, Shema and tefillah. But it can't be talking Shema and tefillah because the third part says tefillah is different. So there's an internal tension in this Mishnah. An internal tension. Let me say it once again. The first part of the Mishnah says what we're talking about. Shema, Tefillah, Tefillin. The third part also says what we're talking about. Just Tefillah. The middle part doesn't say what we're talking about. Doesn't say. So what is the middle part talking about? Well, if the first part was talking about Kriyat Shema and Tefillah and Tefillin, I would think the second part is also talking about that. But that can't be, because the third part says that the law of Tefillah is different. So it must be the second part was not talking about tefillah. Ah, but how could the second part not be talking about tefillah if the first part was? That's a reason for the word tefillah not to be there in the first part. And we saw a text like that. And that text was found in the Yerushalmi. That text was found in the Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi had said, Mishem meto mutal lefanav patur mishma kreshma mina tefillin, and it didn't say tefillah. Now we understand why it didn't say that. Because had it said tefillah there, then tefillah would have to been carried over to the second part of the Mishnah, meaning you'd be exempt in the second part of the Mishnah from Shema and tefillah. But that can't be, because in the third part it says this tefillah's law is different than Shema. I don't know if I'm 20% of you are following, or 50%. Perhaps even everyone. So, that might explain the girsa of the Talmud Yerushalmi. Not that the Talmud Yerushalmi says that in the first part you're not exempt from tefillah, you are, but it can't say it. Can't have that word there. Because of the structure of the rest of the Mishnah. So anyway, with that, let's now understand that this middle part of the Mishnah is a bit strange. It's a bit strange. It said that those who are carrying them beer and their replacements and their replacements, whether they're before the mitah or after the mitah, well, if the mitah needs them, they're patur, and if the mitah doesn't need them, they're chayav. And that's difficult to understand. It's difficult to understand. And I actually wrote for myself an explanation of how I'm going to explain how it's difficult to understand. Right. Because the question I'd put to us is like this. When it says necessary for the mitah, patur, not necessary, hayav, what does necessary mean? If necessary means that those who are carrying, who have not yet carried, as opposed to those who have already carried, if that's what necessary means, didn't carry yet, then say it. Then say, if you carried it already, you're hayav. If you didn't carry yet, or you're carrying now, then you're patur. And if it doesn't mean that, if necessary doesn't mean that you haven't carried yet, then, well, then what does it mean? Is it that even those who have carried already might still be necessary because they might carry again, then say that, or more than say that, then how do you define what necessary means? How do you know if you're going to carry again? I'll say it once again. It would have been easy to say that those who carried already are obligated. Those who are carrying now or didn't carry yet are exempt. That would make sense. If you're doing it or you're about to do it, you're exempt. If you did it already, you're not exempt. But the Mishnah didn't say that. It could have said that in less words, but it didn't. So that's not the halakha. So what is the halakha? It's a matter of necessary or not necessary. Apparently, those who carried already might still be necessary. But how do you know if you're necessary or not? How do you know if it's going to come to you again? So the Mishnah is very difficult. And I just want to say one sentence. That's the reason why there are different texts floating out there. The Bavli is a different text, and we discovered in the Blackman Mishnah, they printed from a different text, from a different manuscript. There's been a lot of fiddling with this Mishnah as far as probably textual emendations in the course of the past 1,000 years in order to understand what's going on.
And if Tzarek is actually what determines putter or not putter, then why even mention who's in front of and behind?
Right, yeah.
I mean, why is front of and behind relevant?
Right, right.
I would like to ask, as a matter of definition, we use the words before and after physically and as a matter of time. Is that true also in this language?
What do you mean as a matter of time?
Before means earlier. In other words, if you've already, could before and after mean if you've already carried or if you haven't yet carried?
Well,
can it be?
It couldn't, because it would be the opposite. Because here you see that.
Yeah,
well, it says whether you've already carried or whether you haven't yet carried is what it means if it's a matter of
right,
time.
Right, so the understanding of the comments, the way they used to do it, is the mitah moved from back to front.
Right.
So those in front, before, are the ones that didn't yet carry. But aren't you saying the opposite?
Well, no, because it's if you're in front, then it's before you carry. If it's whether it's before you've carried or whether it's after you've carried. If you're behind, it's after you've carried.
Okay, so it seems like it might work. I'm not sure myself.
But is it allowed to mean earlier and later? That's my. I mean,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Grant.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
in terms of
yeah,
usage.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I think we should end. You can take the time at home to look at the Girsa in the Talmud Bavli and see how it confuses things even more. In the end, it doesn't teach us anything further than what we learned. So, Shavuot Tov.
Shavuot Tov. Thank you.